Shalom and welcome again to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. In these podcasts, we hope to explore some of the issues that touch on our families, our communities, and ourselves as a result of the revolution in longevity. And you can contact us via our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or via our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And we welcome your comments either on the voicemail icon on the website or directly to me, Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And with great pleasure, we now welcome to the Seekers of Meaning podcast microphone, Rabbi Jeffrey Rubenstein, professor of Talmud of the Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at New York University, and specifically for our purposes on this podcast, the author of a very brand new and really cool book called The Land of Truth, Talmud Tales, Timeless Teachings. Jeff, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Seekers of Meaning. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here today.
The Land of Truth, Talmud Tales, Timeless Teachings, just published by the Jewish Publication Society, available at all the usual outlets, Barnes & Nobles and the great God Amazon, correct?
That's correct, yes.
For colleagues or adult education people who may be tuning into the podcast, serious recommendation, this is a really good resource for Talmud class, adult ed class, etc., really examining the wonderful sea of Talmud, as we sometimes call it. Jeff, let me start up with what motivated you to do this? I know you're a professor of Talmud, but what was did something spark your interest, or this was a culmination of just years of study and you just want to point this out, or what was the motivating factor of writing the book?
Yeah, well, really, the motivating factor was to reach a wider audience and to popularize scholarship and especially the richness of Talmudic stories. Much of my research, much of my scholarship focuses on the stories that are found in the Babylonian Talmud. And I'd written a few books on them and articles for other scholars for an academic audience. But it's such rich material, such interesting material, that I wanted to bring this to a wider audience, to a popular audience, and introduce them to some of the methods, some of the conclusions, some of the approaches that we developed in academic study of these stories and make that available in a way that anybody really could read, anybody who has an interest in Jewish studies, in the history of Judaism, and in the Talmud in general.
So I found it very interesting, right? I think right after the book was published, or sometime after the book was published, there's an article in the foreword in November talking about, I think the title of the article is, Why Should We Teach Our Children Talmud Folk Tales Instead of Grimm's Fairy Tales? It's a great little piece in the foreword in November. And it really talks about, again, the power of telling a story. And I guess the thesis of the article was, why do we need to go to fairy stories and all that stuff when all the richness of the Talmud, the stories of the Talmud. So could you just walk me through you teach this. What's the power of the Talmud stories, the stories that are in the Talmud? And how relevant are they? How can they be so relevant to today's world?
Yeah, well, the Talmud as a whole is a very vast text, as you know. It contains legal discussions on almost every topic that has to do with Jewish law, but it also contains a great deal of agadah, of non-legal material, including stories that address all the dimensions of human existence, marriages, birth, life, death, morals, values, dreams, supernatural world. And many of those non-legal portions are in the forms of narratives, stories. I think to understand the power of these stories, we have to understand that the Talmud is a text that was compiled over the course of many generations. There are six or seven generations of rabbis who take part in the actual Talmudic discussions, whose names appear in the Talmud. And then there were several more generations of editing. So all the material in the Talmud that has come down to us, in a way, is is tested by time. It's only the best material that was passed down, and it was constantly improved and updated and polished over the course of these centuries. So many of these stories that address just dimensions of being a human being or being a good Jew, things that we all experience, aging and suffering and husband and wife relationships and dealing with government or powerful figures, Talmudic sources and Talmudic stories address these issues. And it's the best stories that address them in the most sophisticated and the most meaningful ways that were transmitted. I think we have to understand the stories that weren't that effective or weren't that brilliant, were not passed down, didn't come down to us. So we're really getting the best of Talmudic literature, the best of ancient literature that relates to these different dimensions of human existence. That's really their power in a certain sense.
So it's like the greatest hits album.
It's basically that. Whatever came down to us are great stories. And then when they have to do with something that's relevant to our lives, they hit home. They're meaningful.
I got to ask you one question. You just triggered something in my brain. You know, not everybody can get to one of your classes. And I know there's a resurgence of, in congregations as I travel around North America, of Talmud study, of colleagues and congregations trying to get their people, to really engage in some studies of Talmud. But I'm also seeing, and you probably know this a lot better than I do, little bubble up of apps for phones so people can study Talmud on their phone or their iPad. Are you, you're familiar with some of these? And if so, do you have some that are, if somebody wants to try this out, you would recommend?
I mean, I think these apps are all great in making these texts available and making them easy to access. It's actually one of the great advantages or benefits of social media these days. I mean, I think the one of the best websites, and they have an app for the phone, is Safaria. They've done remarkable work in putting up a whole translation of the Talmud and dozens and dozens and dozens of other texts. It's still in progress. And they also have hundreds and hundreds of study sheets that people have compiled and posted on their website. And they have a phone app where you can access this on your phone. So I think that's a very useful one. And then there are ones that will send you a Mishnah every day to study. And I actually do that. I think it's a great way to have the discipline of making sure you take what it can be 5-10 minutes. You get this little text of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, of course, is the foundation of the Talmud. The Talmud is structured as a commentary to the Mishnah, an earlier law code. And over the course of just a brief amount of time, you can really make some serious progress in familiarizing yourselves with this text in Talmud Torah, in Torah study.
That's so cool. The perception, and you alluded to this, I imagine in many people who see the Talmud as a legal code or legal document and dry, and yet, as you're pointing out, and the book does this superb job, The Land of Truth, Talmud Tales, Timeless Teachings, that the richness of the stories of the Agadah. So you begin the book with this very famous and delightful story of Honi, the circle. Talk to me about this little story and why it has such relevance into the world in which we live.
Yeah, well, Honi is known, of course, from two main stories. One is where he brings rain. He's known as Honi the Circle Maker. He draws a circle and kind of insists to God that he won't move until he brings rain. But there's another story of Honi, which is the one that I wrote about, where Honi is a kind of Rip Van Winkle figure. He ends up falling asleep or being put to sleep for 70 years. And it's a way of him being able to understand a verse that he doesn't understand that talks about the rebuilding of the second temple after 70 years. There was a 70-year exile between the first and second temple. So Honi, in a way, I call it him the surreal sleeper. In his surreal life, is able to understand how 7 years could pass, the verse says, in a dream. But what's interesting about the story is when he wakes up after 70 years, he's kind of alienated. He can't quite relate to the people he meet. They don't believe it's him, and he can't reestablish connections to his family. He can't reestablish connections to his students, generations of students later in the rabbinic academy. And the story ends quite tragically. He prays for death and he dies as a sign of God's mercy. So I take the story in several different ways in the book, but one of the main ways is the dangers and the tragedy we experience as we experience aging, especially nowadays when medical technology can prolong life. But those who actually live quite long sometimes find themselves cut off from the people they know who have died. Sometimes they outlive children, they outlive friends. And Choni, in a way, as I say, ahead of his time, he experiences this many, many years, hundreds of years before it's become, I think, a much more prevalent problem today.
Could you say that one of the messages of that story is that everybody has a time, and it opens the door to a conversation of sometimes or often it's appropriate to leave go, which is very difficult for people, and to allow the next generation to come up?
Yeah, I think that is certainly one way to take the story. I think there is this fascination of time travel. I mentioned in the course of the chapter that many, many writers, many thinkers are enamored with this idea of being able to see the future or to live in subsequent generations. Or even these ways of extending life that we keep trying to do. And one of the ways to understand the story is as a cautionary tale that there is an appropriate time. There is a time that we live in, and it might not be as good as it sounds to live for so long or to live in a future in a world that we are not familiar with and might have trouble relating to.
Yeah, I mean, the whole, you could use this as in the anti-aging movement here, and you know, the push to extend lifespan to the 120 of Moses, but then the ethical religious question is, living is what and how? You alluded to the time travel thing, and I think you write about it not only in the Choni thing, but you allude to it in other parts of the book. Again, to dispel some of the perhaps preconceived notions, there's in the stories in the Talmud, and one of the themes that flow through this, there's dreams, and not only you mentioned time travel, but spirits, etc. That's all there, isn't it? It's a richness of that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole supernatural world there, but there are also a host of colorful characters, figures that rabbis meet, that the protagonists of the Talmudic stories meet. Alexander the Great appears in one of the stories that I discuss in the book. Roman emperors appear in others. Greek philosophers appear in others. So there is this very, very well-defined cast of characters that make some of the stories even richer for these encounters.
We do a lot of work in Jewish sacred aging, obviously with caregiving and riffing off the fifth commandment. And lo and behold, you have this wonderful story and unpacking of the aging and the annoying mom. And you start with the Rav Asi story of the obligations and riffing off Kiddushin. And could you walk me through that? Because it really has great relevance to the work of Jewish sacred aging and to the baby boom generation, many of whom are caring for elderly parents or about to enter a phase where they themselves are expecting their own children to be available to care for them. And then you also allude to at the end of that section, the challenge of what are those obligations of honor and respect due to the parent who abrogates their own responsibilities to their children. It's a very rich chapter and very relatable. Could you just walk me through that?
Sure. I mean, I call this chapter What to Do with an Aged and Annoying Mother. And it's, again, a Talmudic story, as you mentioned, that I think is incredibly relevant. Rav Asi has a mother. Apparently, she's been widowed. And she asks him for many things. She asks him for jewels, and she asks him for other things. He tries to provide for her, and then she asks him to find a new husband for her and to find a husband who's as handsome as he is. And at this point, Rav Asi seems to feel that he's simply going to be subject to an endless amount of demands from his mother. He's never going to be able to satisfy her, and he runs away. He essentially flees to the land of Israel from Babylonia, where he had been living. But you can't quite run away from your problems, as we often learn, and he hears his mother is following after him. She is persistent and not just annoying. And at that point, he's in a conflict because there's a precept that you're not really supposed to leave the confines of the land of Israel, the Holy Land, except for certain very important purposes. And he's not sure this qualifies. He tries to get a straight answer from a rabbi. He doesn't quite get the answer he wants. He keeps trying to get a different answer, but then he hears that his mother has died, and it's her coffin that is coming to meet him. And he ends with a kind of rueful reflection, "Had I known, I would not have left." Although that is a great way of ending the story, because it's full of ambiguity. Does he mean he would not have left the land of Israel to meet her because she's died along the way? Or does he mean, "Had I known, I would never see her again, and she would try so hard to follow after me, I wouldn't have left Babylonia in the first place"? But what the story really deals with is this very, very difficult commandment to honor parents, and how far do you have to go? At what point does that become oppressive? At what point do you kind of lose yourself in a futile quest to satisfy demands that might either be inappropriate or just might be infinite, taking care of parents as they age and become progressively more incapacitated? But on the other hand, I mentioned some studies of families and families who have had kind of rifts where fathers and mothers and children have not spoken to each other for years, who have separated. And those families are very unhappy too. So it's a difficult story. I don't think it comes to a simple answer, but it more manifests to us the problems and the struggles and some of the situations that we might have to deal with. And I think this is true of Talmud stories in general. They get us beyond superficial ways of looking at things, and they get us to deeper realities and to looking at things in a spiritual way, in a deeper way than might appear at first glance. So it might appear at first glance you can solve your problem by moving very far away from parents. But again, it's not clear that simple solution will really work out for you.
No, and I think one of the things you point out also in the book is that the as you study these stories, as you just alluded to, there's a lot of open-ended conclusions, and that, you know, you, depending upon the time in which you are living, the answers may vary. And I think that's the part of the wonderment of the stories themselves, because they do lend themselves to a lot of conversation as opposed to this is the way it has to be.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly true of Talmud stories, and that's true of great literature in general, whether it's modern literature or the classics, that it can't be reduced to one simple answer. And there are different avenues of analysis that open up, and it poses these questions to us, challenges us, tries to invite us to make sense of difficult problems that we confront. And I think that's, like I said, the power of some of these Talmudic stories, why they persisted and were transmitted and came down to us in these forms.
You include towards the end of the book one of the more famous stories, the Hillel Shammai debate about, you know, teach me the Torah and on one foot, etc. And I think that this chapter is called Standing on One Leg. Could you walk me through how that plays out with a special relevance to today's, you know, explosion of interfaith marriage and, you know, challenges of conversion and this, that, and the other thing? It's a very, very relevant story, is it not?
Yeah, well, I think that story can be taken in a couple of ways. It does appear in the context of several other stories of converts who come to Shammai and Hillel, and Shammai, who's portrayed as a somewhat impatient and strident figure, turns these converts away. They don't seem to come with the most pure motives, whereas Hillel accepts them and converts them and then tries to teach them. So on one level, these stories in modeling the behavior of Hillel, clearly the positive role model, are teaching us something about how to welcome converts, how to understand that people might come from a certain position and not from a full place of understanding, and part of the process is bringing them to a more sophisticated understanding of the process and conversion. But I thought there's another dimension to these stories too. In the particular one that I wrote about, the convert demands to be taught the entire Torah standing on one leg. So he's essentially asking for the essence of the Torah. If you could boil the Torah down to one simple thing, what would it be? In other words, I think this is a question put in the mouth of a convert that probably rabbis and others wonder about. There's hundreds of Jewish laws. There's thousands of details of observance. Are there some that are more important? What is the most important thing? Is it observing the Sabbath? Is it treating all people with respect? Is it prayer? What is that one essence of Judaism? And Shammai refuses to boil Judaism, to reduce it to one thing. Hillel gives him this very famous answer: that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. That is the entire Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it. So Hillel, I think, answers in a brilliant way. On the one hand, he does give him one principle. But on the other hand, he tells the convert, you really can't leave it at that. The rest is commentary, but you have to go and learn it. So it's important to learn the rest too. And what I discuss in the chapter is that sometimes the story is transmitted and retold without that crucial ending, as though Hillel just said, here's the essence of the Torah, don't do unto others what's hateful to you. But that is a bit of a misappropriation of the story, because Hillel doesn't leave it at that. He says, you have to go out and learn the rest of it too. I think that's an important lesson that shouldn't be forgotten. In a way, Hillel's abbreviation is abbreviated in an illegitimate way when the story is retold.
Again, picking up on this theme that you write about, and again, we're speaking with Rabbi Jeff Rubenstein, professor of Talmud at the Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU, and the author of a brand new book, The Land of Truth, Talmud Tales, Timeless Teachings, published by Jewish Publication Society, available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, bookstores, everywhere, I would hope and imagine. You deal with, this ongoing theme of the power of the stories of the Talmud have relevance to everyday life, and you have this wonderful chapter called Forbidden Fruit or How Not to Seduce Your Husband, which is guaranteed to get people looking at that chapter, I would imagine. And you allude to some of the little stories like the recent Torah portion with Judah and Tamar, and really introduce us to the idea that sex and sexuality are not taboo within the context of the Talmud. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, in general, marriage is considered a commandment in the Talmud. Sexuality is understood as a part of marriage, as a commandment to reproduce and multiply. There's even a commandment or an obligation to fulfill one's partner sexually, even when children are not an issue, when a woman is pregnant, a postmenopausal woman. So sex is definitely considered one of the gifts that God has given and one of the ways of making a marriage meaningful and providing joy to one's spouse. Now, this Talmudic story actually deals with a rabbi who seems to have decided that he should be celibate in a quest for purity. He withdraws from his wife. His motivation is not clear. It might, I conjecture, be influenced by some contemporary trends in Christianity, which saw celibacy as the ideal. And it's possible that some Talmudic rabbis were influenced by this or attracted by this or tried to minimize or reduce sex in marriage. When his wife realizes that the husband is actually fighting a daily battle against his inclination, against his drives, and it's not that he's withdrawn from her because he of some sort of sexual dysfunction, she decides she's going to come out and seduce him, and she dresses up like a courtesan. That's the reference to the Judah and Tamar story that appears in the Bible, and essentially seduces her husband, who doesn't realize that it's her. So he feels terrible about this rabbi. He feels he has lost his battle for purity because he has given in to his own bodily needs. And he comes home and climbs into an oven and essentially commits suicide, despite the fact that his wife tells him, you didn't sleep with a prostitute, you didn't engage in illicit or illegal sexual relations, you actually slept with me, your lawful wife, who you have an obligation to. So it's a story that also ends in tragedy, but it's one that I think is meant to teach us about the importance of marital relations and the fact that celibacy is not really a Jewish value.
The continuing relevance of Talmud stories. This is why the book is so rich. And I hope people who listen can begin to understand that each one of these stories lends itself to so much interpretation, but contemporary relevance. So for example, I had to ask you about this story and this chapter, The Land of Truth, because you really talk about what we would call fake news. I mean, in any ways, how much truth do you tell? When is it appropriate not to tell the entire truth? And the Talmud story that you use here is about the beautiful bride. Could you just walk us through that? Because it's a great story and everybody can relate to it.
Yeah, that's again, I think, a good example of what we were discussing earlier, that is Talmud stories that address perennial problems of human life, of human existence. In every generation, we have to grapple with when we tell the truth, when we don't tell the truth, when it's legitimate to deceive, when the truth is going to be hurtful so that we should depart from the truth. And the core story that I start with in that chapter, I call it The Land of Truth, because call the book The Land of Truth too, because of this story. But a rabbi comes to a city where everybody tells the truth. It's a kind of utopia. They never lie. And the residents of that city live full lives. No one ever dies early. The assumption in this story and elsewhere in the Talmud is an unnatural death. An early death is punishment for sin. Otherwise, why would you die early? So the people in this town are so good, so virtuous in their truth-telling that they all live exceptionally long lives. They're full lives. And this rabbi, he marries a woman, he settles there. But one day, a neighbor comes to the door asking for his wife, who's washing her hair. And he doesn't want to tell her she's washing her hair. That was considered immodest. Might be like if someone came to our house and our spouse was in the bathroom and we didn't want to say, he or she is on the toilet, and we might dissemble or say something else. So this rabbi essentially lies, even though it's what you might call a white lie, and then his children die. And the residents of the town realize that he's brought death to their city, and they ask him to leave. So it's a very, very difficult story, because on the one hand, it kind of idealizes truth, and it says how important it is to tell the truth. But on the other hand, it's a fictional story. And in the context of other stories, it becomes clear that it's impossible to always tell the truth. This is not a utopia in the sense that we can realize it. It's really a kind of counterfactual society, because there are times where it's important to protect people's privacy, to protect people's modesty. And the story you ask about, the bride on her wedding day, who's an ugly bride, Well, it's important to in that situation to praise the bride and tell her how beautiful she is, even though that might not be the truth. So the Talmud is really wrestling with this question of when it's appropriate to depart from the truth. But if you look at it in a larger context, there certainly are situations when it is appropriate, and there are situations when it's not. And then I think the Talmud is trying to tell us through this is that ideally we wish we could be in a world where we could always tell the truth. That would be so honest. That would be easy, of course, in a certain sense. But it really wouldn't work. It wouldn't work because it would come into conflict with some of these other values, shaming other people and compromising on their modesty. And that's really the challenge, again, that this story, the series of stories poses to us. How can we understand better in our own lives what situations call for the truth and when it is legitimate or even necessary, even mandated to depart from that strict truth.
Would you say the theme or position of the Agadah is contextual? In other words, the mood of the Talmud really does understand that responses, just like the chapter that you were talking about, does the context of the case before it or us really does determine or can determine how we respond?
Yeah, I think that's true to some extent. I wouldn't go so far to say that the Talmud does not think there's certain absolutes or there's certain fundamental principles or there's certain values that cannot be compromised. But that's true. In many, many cases, the Talmud does say you have to respond to the situation and look at the larger context, and they can't give you simple answers. That's why stories and Agadah are so prominent, because law can often be expressed in terms of straightforward rules. But human life is more complex than that. And the Talmud gives us these stories as a way to think about the context and the situations and the different possibilities that we encounter. And in a way to teach us, these stories are didactic. They're trying to teach us to respond with wisdom and with sensitivity to the many, many situations and contexts that we're going to encounter.
You study this, you teach this at NYU. Do you have a favorite character in the Talmud?
Well, there happens to be a very, very interesting character, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, who happens to be my favorite. He's a rabbi who's a bit on the outside. He's different than many of the other rabbis. He seems to have a different legal tradition. He has a different understanding on the nature of the tradition. So he's a bit of an outsider. And in one story, the rabbis actually kind of put him under a ban, a kind of excommunication or ostracism. So in a sense, he's a tragic figure, but he's also one of great integrity. And the stories of Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus are some of the most fascinating in the Talmud to me.
As I said before, Jeff, there are a growing number of colleagues who really want to bring the richness of this literature into Amcha, into congregation land. You teach us at NYU, you've written the books, you're an expert on this. What piece of advice would you give that colleague in a congregation who says, you know, this is so relevant, it's so powerful, how can I make this live for my members? How can I introduce this other than being, you know, totally frontal and didactic?
Well, I think that is one of the great things about teaching stories and why they're very, very good to teach in adult education settings. You know, Talmud or Mishnah or Jewish law or some other things really do require an expertise. And when you teach Talmud then to a class, it is much more frontal lecturing. It's the expert or the rabbi teaching the class about this text. Stories is something, narratives is something that we all encounter. We all read literature. We don't all read Talmudic literature, but we all read short stories. We all read novels. So everyone can contribute to the understanding of stories. And in fact, many of the insights in this book and many of the different angles, I always try to multiply the interpretations of the stories in each chapter, emerged from my teaching these stories in adult education settings, sometimes in undergraduate classes, sometimes just in synagogues. and people making observations and raising points and having insights that I hadn't thought about myself, but I thought were reasonable or plausible or even brilliant possible interpretations of stories. So I think for rabbis, I would say this is great material to run an adult education class or to teach in some sort of group setting, high school, even day school. You don't really need to be an expert. You just need to put out the story there and start a discussion and ask the questions we ask of all literature. What is the conflict? What is this character like? What is the storyteller trying to tell us? And now there are these resources that are available where these stories can be accessed in good translations, like Safaria. There's another book that I published called Rabbinic Stories that gives many, many more stories just in English translations with a few notes. But these can be used as texts in these classes. And my experience is that people really enjoy reading them and they feel empowered to contribute because they feel it's a story. I can read a story. I can have some insights about it.
And I can see my own story in it too, probably in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, people relate to different aspects of it, and that's some of the new insights that come because people are coming from different perspectives, and they see themselves or they see something that's relevant to them that you might not see or someone else might not see.
Rabbi Jeffrey Rubenstein, author of The Land of Truth, Talmud Tales and Timeless Teachings, Jewish Publication Society, professor of Talmud in the Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU. Jeffrey, thank you very, very much. It has been fascinating. And again, this is a great resource book. And for colleagues out there, educators who want to, you know, bring this to our people in a wonderful, wonderful way, I certainly hope you can check this book out and order it and use it within your community, your congregation, your chavura, whatever. So thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you very, very much. And continued success.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. And thank all of you again for joining us on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. A reminder that we welcome comments and contact at our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or you can send them to me, Rabbi Address, at jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you as well to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin and recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Thanks again for joining us. We look forward to greeting you on the next Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you and shalom.